Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a look at the role of the private financial regime within the deep state. My guest from Japan is James Corbett. James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, a website he started in 2007 to provide critical analysis on politics, society, economics, and history. He has written, recorded, and hosted thousands of hours of audio and video, which has brought him to the attention of major independent media such as RT. James is also a host of Eye Opener on BoilingFrogs.com and produces video reports for GRTV, run by Global Research in Canada. He is the lead editorial writer for the International Forecaster. He has also directed several very important documentaries, including How Big Oil Conquered the World and His Century of Enslavement, is perhaps the best film exposing the dark history and corruption of the Federal Reserve System. His website, with his numerous podcasts, audio, and video programs, is CorbettReport.com. Nice to have you with us today, James.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
James, during the past several months, I've been doing a lot of programs on various aspects of the deep state, or what are also called the shadow government. So although we tend to associate the deep state with our federal intelligence agencies, including the CIA, the Pentagon, there are many other fundamental players in the private sector that are not given sufficient attention. Most notably is the financial industry. Wall Street, as well as the Federal Reserve System. So when we speak of the U.S. no longer being a functioning democracy and rather an oligarchy that is controlled by and benefits the interest of a very tiny elite, we're dealing with a cartel of individuals unelected by the people who have enormous influence and control over domestic and international policies. Their power is, in some sense, overriding the mandates of our elected legislators and even the White House. And I think this should be clear to all who we consider that so many of Obama's cabinet members were in fact handpicked by Wall Street, by an executive within the banking community. He selected almost the entire central cabinet. But the media never talked about that. I would like to look at the Federal Reserve, but before we do, please explain how you observe the gradual transformation over the years on how the government has de-evolved from a democracy to an oligarchical state that operates now as a shadow government, accountable to no one, exposed by none of the media. And can you note some of the most salient events or trends you witness that has contributed to the creation of a rule by the deep state or shadow government? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, thank you for that. It's an important question, and it brings up so much history and so many associations that the mind boggles at where to begin with it. And I think the obvious beginning, or at least one of the beginnings that would seem to be obvious, would be the creation of the national security state itself in 1947 with the passage of the National Security Act, which ultimately led to the formation of the CIA and various other deep state organs that we now associate with that term, deep state or shadow government. And I think that you could, there's a perfectly plausible, logical history that could be written from that as a starting point that would go, for example, in through the 1950s and the beginnings of the CIA destabilization operations in Guatemala, in Iran, in other states that were overthrown by admitted now. This is not conspiracy theory. This is admitted historical record of CIA destabilization operations to oust various presidents that they democratically elected leaders of different countries that were not in the CIA. Interests. And it would also be important to note along that line of reasoning that when we talk about the CIA's interests, especially during that period, the early formative period of the CIA, we're essentially talking about Wall Street's interests, because the actual people who made up the CIA, especially at that time, especially under the directorship and leadership of Alan Dulles, were all Wall Street lawyers, as Dulles himself was, and his brother being Secretary of State at the time that he was at the head of the CIA, and they both had connections to Wall Street law firms. That was really the core nucleus of much of that nascent deep state back as it existed at that time. And I think that makes sense of a lot of these operations that were launched around the globe to, for example, destabilize various countries. When you look at the various business interests that that played a part in really creating the cause of the operations themselves. So, of course, you have to look at oil and the nationalization of various business interests in Iran as the reason that they went in and overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953, for example. Kermit Roosevelt being the one, the lead point man on that particular destabilization operation. Again, those types of things come to mind when we start talking about the formation of the deep state. But I think, again, it's probably most obvious to point to November 22nd, 1963, as the point at which the deep state, the shadow government, at least emerged somewhat from the swamp that it wallows in to show itself as the evident real leaders and decision makers of the country. Because if you can blow a president's head off in the middle of the day with a complete impunity, it all being blamed on one lone gunman patsy, if you can get away with that, then essentially you control the state in one way or another. And again, it's probably not for a lot of people who are well versed in this, it's probably not controversial to say that no president since then certainly has ever talked about breaking the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scattering them to the winds, as JFK did shortly before having his head blown off. There's obvious, I think, a moment at which we could say the coup itself really took place. And from that point, no executive has ever truly challenged the deep state. And you could move further on from that. I think the next moment that would obviously be one of those moments that had the deep state's fingerprints all over it and was flashing red lights all throughout the system was, of course, 9/11/2001, the day that changed everything, as we've been told many, many times. And then moving forward from that, I think a good indication of where the point that we're at now is exactly as you say. It's a story that most people probably missed in all of the other craziness that was going on in the election cycle last year. But in the WikiLeaks dump of Podesta's emails that were released by WikiLeaks late last year during the election cycle, probably one of the most jaw-dropping single emails was an email from Michael Froman, who was at that time an executive of Citigroup. And this email was written to Podesta, who at that time was chairing Barack Obama's transition team, on October 6th of 2008. So keep that in mind. October 6th of 2008 is a full month before the election actually took place, the selection, as I like to say. And yet at that time, Michael Froman was, an executive at Citigroup, was writing Obama's transition team chair the list of what would essentially become his cabinet. He picked out pretty much everything. Holder at Justice Department, Napolitano at Homeland Security, Rahm Emanuel for Chief of Staff, Shinseki for Veterans Affairs, Kathleen Sebelius, Health and Human Services. All of these people were picked out in this email and suggested, quote unquote, by Michael Froman. And of course, he also suggested three possibilities for Treasury Secretary: Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and Timothy Geithner. And of course, as we know, Timothy Geithner ended up getting the appointment. So it's remarkable how that all works out. Again, that was 1 month before the selection even took place, and yet there was the cabinet all sitting there in an email from an executive at Citigroup. And I think that shows a couple of things. First of all, it shows, of course, the extent of control that that banking executives have continue to have. Persist in having right to the current day and age, the actual composition of various administrations. But secondly, perhaps more interestingly, because again, for people who've been researching this, that in and of itself is not particularly startling, but the fact that very few people know about this email and not a lot of people seem to particularly care. In fact, it's almost seen as kind of par for the course at this point. People have become so numb to these types of revelations that they're not really even revelations anymore. And what does that say about a society that has just taken this kind of kind of fall of the Roman Empire level craziness as just par for the course. That I think that indicates something about the point, the historical point that we're at. I would tend to say, in line with people like Douglas Valentine, who I know has talked about this recently, he points out the deep state isn't necessarily anything different than the state. It's just a part of the state, and it's always there, and it functions that way. You call it what you will. It's been called different things at different times throughout history, but it's always existed. There's always a clique, a crony, would-be oligarchy that clings to those offices of power, wherever they may be. And they generally, although of course there are secret operations, a lot of what they do is out in the open, and a lot of their names are out there in the open for people who really want to dig down and research the names and the histories and the connections and what this particular office is doing and what this person, you know, who he's meeting with. All of that is to a large extent actually on the record. It's just that that would require an awful lot of work, so it's easier to kind of smudge everything around with the term deep state. But again, when you break it down, a lot of these connections do have to, they revolve around financial interests and other types of interests as well. I mean, you could point to organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission and Bilderberg Group and things like that. But fundamentally, where a lot of these people are placed are in positions of finance, where they have access to large amounts of funds to do things like buy off politicians at will.
I appreciate the overview, James. I have a little different perspective on it, and I'd like your thoughts. I was looking at all the banter back and forth between Rachel Maddow and the MSNBC and the left and the New York Times, CNN, and those on the right, Fox, National Review, etc., the triumvirate of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. And what all the argument comes down to is one says that all of our problems in America are due to liberals. The other says all of our problems are due to the conservatives and the neoconservative agenda. And I decided once I found that email that you're talking about to Podesta, from Podesta, I then went back and looked at all the cabinets for the last 36 years. They all had something in common. All of the cabinet picks, the important cabinet picks, were very successful, the top of their game, but not one of them, I couldn't find one that had a reputation for helping resolve problems for the common person, for the average middle class, working middle class, poor person. To the contrary, like Wilbur Ross, he's also known as a vulture capitalist, they make their money from the weaknesses in the system, exploiting the downside of a system. And you look at DeVos, the current Secretary of Education, she's never taught in a school. She doesn't even have any of the advanced degrees. But her family's multi-billions of dollars. And at a certain level of financial pedigree, it doesn't matter if you have no skills or talent in anything. You're simply invited because they want the inner circle of successful people, no matter what background or field they're in, to come and to Davos, where they all get together, about 1,500 people more or less every year, and they talk about the state of the world as if they're experts. Now, they're all experts at exploiting money from the system through debt, through leveraged buyouts, through equity partnerships, through hedge funds, through manipulating systems, through corporatization of issues. But that means they've made money exclusively for the shareholders, their partners themselves, but never for the people. So when they talked about draining the swamp, I'm thinking it's not just this one man from Citigroup that selected Obama's cabinet and the liberal community didn't have boo to say about it. Now the liberal community is all over every cabinet pick, and rightly so, that Trump has selected. Well, where's the hypocrisy there? They didn't say a word over Bill Clinton's two tenures of selecting the swamp monsters, nor George Bush's selections, nor Ronald Reagan's selection. Remember Bloomberg and his kitchen cabinet. All those people, Bloomingdale, all those people and the head of American Express, they were all successful, but not at making money for other people. So all cabinet members are the same way. And then you have all these military, ex-military people who are always brought in with their credentials and their pedigree, dragging on the floor, showing why the only answer to any threat or perceived threat is a militarized threat. So now you got the experts appearing in television, or on television, in radio, in the media, telling us we've got to put boots on the ground, we've got to get nuclearized for the next go-round. Never anyone saying, what about diplomacy? Why are we there in the first place? Shouldn't we be out of these countries? So I'm looking at it saying the entire establishment at the policymaking level for the last at least 36 years has been nothing but swamp monsters in the cesspool called Washington, D.C. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure where you think we would disagree with that assessment, because that's, in fact, exactly my assessment, that there is no such thing as a non-swamp monster politician. Fundamentally, I'm a double outsider to this conversation, I suppose, being Canadian in Japan, so I'm not an American. And furthermore, I'm not a statist. I am an anarchist, so I do not believe there is such thing as legitimate political authority. And as such, I think, at any rate, I certainly do transcend the left-right bickering that preoccupies almost everyone to a very disturbing extent when you start to look at it from an outside perspective and see how thoroughly that programming does work to keep people pitted at each other's throats rather than seeing the fundamental problems of the system. And I think you gestured towards that quite effectively when you look at the hyper-partisan media, the blame everything on the liberals or blame everything on the conservatives, the neocons, it's always a question of, well, they did it, so we can do it, or, oh, well, we did it better than they did it, or those types of issues, rather than looking at the fundamental problem. And I think, again, I don't see any point of disagreement with us on that accord, because certainly there has been, if anything, a startling continuity of agenda. Certainly, I'm within my lifetime, I'm 37 years old, so really, I mean, I came of age politically in the Bill Clinton era, and seeing the baton being passed between Clinton and Bush and Obama and Trump has been a pretty seamless series of transitions from my point of view. Again, as an outsider watching this from overseas, but it is certainly, I think the startling continuity of it all is when contrasted with the way that people tend to place their entire emotional identity in one side or other of the spectrum, one color, it comes down to red versus blue. It's a thing to behold when you look at social engineering from that perspective. And that's really my sort of outside take on this, because again, I don't really have a dog in the fight either way, and I completely agree with the idea that this is essentially an oligarchy, and that's all it has ever been, and I think all that it can ever really be is at best a benevolent oligarchy, but there will always be people circling around in those positions of power, because those are precisely the types of positions that psychopaths and criminals are attracted to.
Very, very insightful. Thank you, James. I feel it's important for listeners to understand some of the Federal Reserve's history. You described the founding of the Fed as being a coup d'etat back in 1913 and perhaps earlier to 1910 to dominate and monopolize the nation's money supply. So take us back to its origins and the long-term goal of the bankers or the business leaders who created the Federal Reserve. Who were they? What was their vision at that time? For example, it was intended 100 years ago to run an economy that would create money out of thin air. Yes or no? I don't know if they understood that at that time. We didn't have computers then. And then looking at today's economic system of governance and control, how successful were they? And when you think of the corruption of Wall Street and Goldman Sachs, often comes immediately to mind, they are like the Monsanto of Wall Street that people would identify as all really existentially incompatible with governing anything. And what are some of the historical activities of Goldman Sachs that my listeners ought to know and which are indicative of the Wall Street domestic and global agenda?
Well, when we talk about the Federal Reserve and its creation, I think it's important to understand it in the historical context of the United States more generally, and the fact that the argument over whether or not to have a central bank and in what way that it should function and what kind of charter it should be acting under was really one of the prime political debates of the time of the actual founding of the country. And Hamilton, of course, basically was arguing against Jefferson at that time, and Hamilton ultimately ended up winning that debate. And in 1791, the first central bank of the United States was chartered. That went by the wayside after its 20-year charter, but it was revived as the Second Bank of the United States in 1816, and again for a 20-year charter. And that ultimately, and in 1836, it was killed by President Jackson, who said, "I killed the bank," was apparently his greatest achievement, is what he was attributed as saying on his deathbed. And it was a 77-year period from that point until the founding of the Federal Reserve in 1913. And as you say, we can go back to 1910 for the founding of what became the Federal Reserve in a secret meeting on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia between some of the most influential bankers of the time, including a lot of people who were representing the J.P. Morgan interests, including, for example, Paul Warburg and Nelson Aldrich, who was a powerful senator at that time. These people met in complete secrecy. No one knew that where they were going or what they were doing. In fact, they didn't even use each other's real first names with each other. No, they only used first names, I should say, so that even the servants and other staff that were around wouldn't know who they were. They were very careful about secrecy because they knew if all of these powerful banking interests were seen at this very sensitive time in American history, very soon after the crash of 1907, in which a lot of people were panicking and crying out for some sort of central bank. Well, they knew if they were discovered in their secret project, then it would come crashing down around them, and people would reject whatever they came up with. So they met in secret in 1910 on Jekyll Island for a period of about a week, and they came out with what became really ultimately the Federal Reserve Act. As expected, in fact, Senator Aldrich, who at that time was the head of the powerful Finance Committee, did come back to Washington and present that as an Aldrich bill. But it was shot down because everyone knew Aldrich was basically in bed with the powerful monetary interests at the time, and so everyone rightly suspected him. They ended up basically reviving it, changing a little bit of the window dressing, and passing it in a revised form a few years later, and that became the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve system is fundamentally they call it a decentralized central bank. It has a structure in which there's a board of governors, which does things like set interest rates and other things that affect the economy generally. And then it has reserve banks that are located around the country that perform a number of operations, some of which quite benign, check clearing operations and things of that sort, and others more nefarious. And of that system of the, I believe, 10 or 13 regional banks. The most important regional bank was the New York Federal Reserve, obviously the home of Wall Street. And that was where the power of the Federal Reserve system was, and arguably still to a large extent is, although perhaps less so now than at the time of the Federal Reserve's founding. And I think to get a good sense of what the Federal Reserve is, what it really is meant to do, it's a cartel. It is owned and operated by the large private banks, and majority so by the interests on Wall Street that control the most important part of it, the New York Federal Reserve branch. And it acts in a function of serving the interests of those banks. So the perfect example of that is what happened in the 2008 meltdown. Exactly what the bankers would have wanted to happen, the incredible bailout program that was rolled out, and not just the $700 billion TARP program that got all the headlines, but the trillions upon trillions of dollars of emergency lending that was extended to, well, a number of organizations that were connected, surprise, surprise, to the very people sitting on the very boards that were deciding where to hand out the loans. So, I mean, just as one example, although you could find a lot of them, Jeffrey Immelt, who at that time was the chief executive of General Electric, was also serving as a director on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And The Fed was providing $16 billion in financing to General Electric. J.P. Morgan Chase chief executive Jamie Dimon was also a member of the New York Fed and also voted to extend $391 billion in emergency lending to J.P. Morgan. In all, there was Federal Reserve Board members were tied to $4 trillion in loans to their own banks. This is the type of system that comes into place when you have essentially what some people might have thought in 1913 was going to be some sort of watchdog over the banking system and the economy and the lender of last resort and all of that sort of fluff, which it, to a certain extent is true, but perhaps peripherally so. At heart, what it is the banking interests controlling where the banks, where the Federal Reserve directs its power and where it doesn't, what falls through the cracks. And that, I think, addresses the other part of your question, talking about Goldman Sachs, which has been around for 150 years or so now in one form or another, but wasn't really the player that it is now until the 1990s, when various chief executives and or high-ranking directors of Goldman Sachs started leaking into the Clinton administration. And from that point forward, we've seen a suspiciously large and ever-growing number of high-ranking politicians, not just in the U.S., but in Europe and elsewhere around the globe, getting into very high positions of political power. And so this revolving door between Goldman Sachs and the government is sometimes referred to as Government Sachs, appropriately enough. And in that regard, we can see, for example, Goldman Sachs fingerprints in the 2008 crisis that we were talking about there with the bailout emergency loans, where, for example, some of the big losers in all of that were, of course, Bear Stearns getting bought out at $10 a share. Bear Stearns was a direct competitor with Goldman Sachs and not well liked, to say the least, by Goldman Sachs and others on Wall Street for a scandal that happened back in 1998 involving something called Long-Term Finance Capital, I believe was the name of the company that went under. It was a big scandal. A bunch of different banks chipped in for the bailout that ultimately resulted from that scandal back in 1998. One significant holdout was Bear Stearns. So it has been at least speculated that in retaliation, they were not helped out during that 2008 crisis. And another, of course, obviously Lehman Brothers went under, another direct competitor for fixed services with Goldman Sachs. But one company that scored big time and was basically helped from death's doorstep was AIG, the insurance company, which was tied up through these exotic credit default swap deals with people like Goldman Sachs, who would have been left holding the bag for billions and billions of dollars if AIG had been allowed to go under. So they weren't allowed to go under. So this is the way that we can see the Federal Reserve System really functioning at its base. It is a cartel. It directs funds as well as help and support here and there in places that it's needed. And of course, overall, it directs the economy in terms of its ability to set, quote unquote, the price of money by setting interest rates. They can jack up interest rates and cause certain political effects, and they can lower interest rates and cause certain political effects. They can also produce certain economic effects. And as always in an economy, whether prices are rising or falling, as long as you know ahead of time what's going to happen, there is a way for you to make money from that. And that's why we see stunning, incredible year after year record profits coming out of banks like Goldman Sachs that have these revolving doors into the highest levels of power in government.
A question that bothers me concerns why we don't see more insiders going public as whistleblowers and bringing the public attention it deserves to the degree of corruption and fraud in our financial and political systems. And unless an individual gets caught red-handed in some sort of tax business or sexual scandal, we don't hear about our elite, non-democratic, subversive activities except in the alternative independent media. Then we do hear it, you know, like Global Research or Progressive Radio Network. So if Wall Street and our intelligence agencies and legislators are so corrupt, then the question is, why aren't we seeing more employees coming forward as whistleblowers And then who or what controls employees to keep them aligned to the deep state?
That's a good question. And I think fundamentally, a large portion of the answer is that these are not just random people randomly selected from the population who are in the highest corridors of power in firms like Goldman Sachs. These are people who are self-selected to a large extent, people who are highly motivated to work for large Wall Street investment firms or investment banks. And when you talk about people like that, generally speaking, their interests are aligned and their worldview is largely aligned with the one that they're stepping into. It's seldom that you'll see someone who truly is living in La La Land that believes that they're doing, as Lloyd Blankfein infamously said in a 2009 interview, God's work on Wall Street, connecting people who have capital with people who need capital. What could be more wholesome and American than that, is the way they like to portray it. But of course, I think no one really buys that propaganda, least of all the people who were involved in it. So there's, I think, very few people who have the scales fall from their eyes when they set foot on a Goldman Sachs trading floor or something like that. It's just a question. These are generally people who are prepared for something of a ruthless living that they're making from this. Now, I guess we could point to certain people that have come out, like, for example, Greg Smith, I think famously put his retirement on the front page of, or on the op-ed page of the New York Times a few years ago, why I am leaving Goldman Sachs. And he parlayed a book deal out of it. But if you actually go and read the book, it's not exactly scandalous, you know, roof-raising things that he's revealing in that book. One gets more the impression that this is a man who kind of thought he was going to get into a high-ranking director position and ultimately didn't get it. One gets a bit of that sort of, you know, jaded sense from it. So I think there's probably more defectors in that sense, people who feel that they should have gotten, you know, a better deal than they did, but not so many people who are of good character who do blow the whistle. And then when people like that do emerge from the system, they're generally sideline would probably be the best way to put it. I mean, you can look at someone, for example, like Naomi Prince, who did have a career at Bear Stearns and at Goldman Sachs, and who has obviously gone on to write entire books about the banking system and how corrupt it is, and is extremely intelligent and very active source of information on that front. It's not that she's censored per se. It's not that there's any sort of active campaign, or at least not that I know of, to keep her, you know, out of the corridors of power. It's just that to a large extent, there's only a certain section of the publishing industry, for example, that would be willing to publish books like the ones that she writes, or that would be willing to interview an author like that. And it's really kind of one of those self-censorship systems that has functioned to a large extent as the key method of censorship certainly, again, in post deep state USA, at least since the 1940s and since things like Operation Mockingbird, where, as we know, the CIA has placed people in positions of editorial control in various publishing industries over the years, although honest, they don't do it anymore. Ha ha ha. So I think that's really the answer to it. There are people who come out. There's the HSBC whistleblower and Naomi Prinz and people like that. But again, they just don't get the press. They don't get the attention as others do. And without that oxygen, basically, the fire can be contained.
Adding to what you just said, there are nations now who are realizing how much of a disadvantage they are in by remaining on the petrodollar. And yet the petrodollar might be associated with perhaps a good portion of the turmoil we see in other countries like the Ukraine, which because of the West energy and needs and the exploitation of those resources then resulted in a coup that America supported and then blame Russia. But also look at Iraq, Syria, even Yemen, Iran, where oil plays a fundamental role. Why is the petrodollar so important for current global economic regime? And what would be the consequences if it were to collapse? And what are the alternatives to the petrodollar that would be more equitable to nations?
Well, the petrodollar will end. I think it's just a question of what way will it end. I suppose monetary transitions can happen in orderly fashion or disorderly fashion, and you could even look at the creation of the petrodollar as an example of that orderly fashion transition. It doesn't necessarily mean it was for the good, but at any rate, it didn't result in worldwide economic apocalypse. And specifically, we're talking about the system that was developed in the 1970s through some deft diplomacy, I suppose we could say, by Henry Kissinger, who helped to set up a system that involved a deal with Saudi Arabia, for example, probably of primary importance in this relationship, to price their oil in dollars so that they would only accept dollars, obviously, for payment of their oil, and thus setting the benchmark that all of the OPEC nations, for example, adhere to. And then as a secondary arm of that, taking those dollars that were then earned through the oil sales and recycling them through the U.S. banking system by primarily buying treasuries and other financial instruments from U.S. banks, like, for example, David Rockefeller's Chase Bank and others like that, that benefited to the tune of billions back then in the 70s from it, however much they've benefited from it in the intervening decades. And that is essentially the backing, if you will, of the world monetary system in the way that the post-World War II system was supposedly backed by the Bretton Woods Agreement, which pegged all of the currencies in one way or another, or all of the participating currencies, I should say, to the U.S. dollar, which itself was backed by the ratio of $1 at $35 an ounce of gold. So that was the pegging, and that was the basis for the system. But when people started getting scared and pulling their gold out of the American banking system, and the Fed started running out of actual physical gold, they had to switch to something, and that's when Nixon closed the gold window and they started the petrodollar system. So that's the basis of the system, and like every other monetary system, world reserve system that has ever existed, it will pass at some point, and we may already be on the verge of that. But it is one of those strange games where everyone is playing the game, and in order to start playing a different game, they know they'll have to exit the game at some point. But if you exit and you don't have that backup, you don't have the other system already in place, then you risk becoming basically the odd one out, holding a deck of worthless cards, playing a game with no one else, and you're probably going to lose. So that's a bit of a strained analogy, but it paints the picture. For example, sometimes China is depicted as having a nuclear option of being able to dump $1 trillion of U.S. treasuries on the markets all at once and just exit the U.S. dollar system. At least at this point, they really don't have the leverage to be able to do that, because that would primarily hurt China at first anyway. In fact, Saudi Arabia has already threatened to do this, and China has already liquidated several $100 billion of U.S. treasuries in the last few years. That has not yet caused the collapse of the U.S. Financial system, the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency, or even the U.S. bond markets, which in fact, if anything, are thriving. Paradoxically enough. So it really is a question of who will be the first to withdraw, and in what way will they walk out the door. And I think that's why we can see this in the kind of coded moves that are being made with a little bit of fanfare, but mostly behind the scenes right now. For example, in the last week, Russia has come out to reconfirm something that they had already talked about a couple of years ago, but they've reconfirmed that the entire Russian banking system is ready at any moment for a switch from the current SWIFT transaction system, which is the international communications network through which banks talk to each other and funds are wired back and forth and all of that. The banking system is founded on this SWIFT network, but we already saw with the Iran debacle of a few years ago, the sanctions, that the SWIFT network can be used as a weapon, basically, as it was by the United States, which pressured the SWIFT network into delisting Iranian banks, effectively cutting Iran off from the rest of the world and even from each other if they were communicating on the SWIFT network, which can obviously basically cripple an entire nation. Russia read the writing on the wall with the Ukraine coup and it being blamed on them and said, well, we're going to create our own SWIFT network. And they've reconfirmed in the past week that the Russian banking system is ready to switch over to the Russian equivalent of the SWIFT network at any time, and they'll be able to continue talking with each other. And we see the continuing I don't know if fallout is quite the right word, but the continuing progress, I guess, of the accords that were met between Russia and China last year with regards to the natural gas and oil deal that they've signed recently. They're continuing economic cooperation, including continuing their strengthening of ties in terms of yuan denominated transactions. They're going to start denominating more of their import and exports in yuan instead of in dollars. Again, another at least chiseling away at the strength of the dollar as the world reserve currency. And I think that's the way that we've been seeing this progress for several years now, the rise of peripheral, quote unquote, currencies like the yuan in world trade. But it is still still the vast majority of world trade is the world, the dollar. So I think there are a lot of people that really want to make sure that there is some sound alternative that they can switch to before they rush out the door and basically try to collapse the whole system. Because generally speaking, the people who rush out the door first are going to be the ones who end up in trouble. And the worst part of all of this is that we have seen moments like this in history before. For example, the 1930s was an example of a time in the seizing up of world trade, which was a factor with the depression that was going on in the United States and globally, really, at that time. But it involved a lot of tariffs and barriers and beggar thy neighbor policies and devaluations of currencies that were essentially trade wars. And of course, we all know where that ultimately led to, which was actual war. And that's why I think this is such an important question for the next few years, where we really could see a changeover from the petrodollar system. The question is whether it will be one that will be at least somewhat kind of seamless as the transition from Bretton Woods to the petrodollar, or will it be something more like a 1930s kind of meltdown and leading to actual war? And way, it's not necessarily pretty, but it can definitely be much uglier when it involves real bloodshed.
There are several issues I would like you to tie together, if you would. One is the entire major media, including the liberal media, not asking a basic question concerning Hillary Clinton's campaign. And that would be virtually all the major bankers, the industrialists in every area, whether it's food, like Monsanto, or all the banking communities, the military-industrial complex, the insurance industries, everyone in corporate America supported her. They should have asked why. Why would they vote for a person who promised so much to women and the poor and the middle class and the unions? Because their interests are not the same. The people backing her and what she was pledging are completely antithetical. Secondly, when you look at the larger economy, you're looking at, in the United States, approximately $160 to $172 trillion of debt. You're looking at a realistic 22 to 24% actual unemployment rate, not the fantasy numbers projected. You're looking at more than 270 million Americans living just above, at, or below the poverty level, 16.8 million hungry children in the United States, between 2 to 3 million Americans living on less than $2 a day. You have 2.4 million homeless children who go to school but have no home to go to. You had 24 million Americans total who got thrown out of 7 million homes, about 4 per home. And yet we have a Wall Street index of 21,000 approaching. This is a huge bubble. We have a credit card bubble, car loan bubble, a real estate bubble again, a commercial real estate bubble, student loan bubble. We are one gigantic, overblown economy. And yet we're told all this is good. It shows that people are spending money again and buying again. Could you give us your analysis of this? And in light of the fact that had Hillary Clinton been elected president, three things are almost certain to have happened. She would have given support to Israel to have invaded Iran, causing a new war in the Middle East. She would have also done nothing for the working class person, the poor, unions, or the environment. And she would have continued allowing all the monetary policy of the United States government to be controlled by her council of economic advisors, all of whom were supportive of the Wall Street model. Could you deal with this in any part of this?
Well, just as clarification, is the suggestion that any of that is in fact different from what Trump is doing?
No.
That's exactly, I think, the point of it, is that I think that there was a groundswell of people who voted against Hillary more so than they voted for Trump, because they really did see the writing on the wall when it came to issues exactly like that. And of course, this was personified in such things as the Goldman Sachs speeches that she made, receiving $600,000 for three, I believe, speeches to Goldman Sachs that she would not release the transcripts of, and all of that. And that's, of course, just one tiny piece of that puzzle, but I think it is representative of that puzzle, that clearly this was someone who represented those rich, powerful corporate elitist interests. That is exactly why they lined up in lockstep behind her. And so voting for Trump, well, hopefully we'll get something different. And I personally don't think anything fundamentally has changed at this point. And in fact, when we look at the government sex aspect of it, if anything, Trump has just turned that up with, I believe, six important people in his cabinet coming directly from Goldman Sachs, including, of course, the Treasury Secretary, and including one of his chief economic advisors, who was the former president of Goldman Sachs, and who was on the nightly news just a week or two ago saying that we must let the Federal Reserve do its job. It's doing a great job, and we respect its power. So that is the kind of thing that I think we're going to get under President Trump. That's the kind of thing that we were going to get under President Clinton if that had eventuated. So I don't think that fundamentally, I don't think that the answer to the problems that politicians create is going to come from other politicians. I think the real solution to the mess that has been created involves understanding the mess itself, which is not so much a political mess insofar as it is actually a monetary, it is baked into the monetary cake that people are living in. The current prevailing paradigm of you have the US dollar Federal Reserve notes, that is money, that is how you interact and transact with everyone else. That's just how you have to make a living. That's what you have to pay with. That's the way you grew up, the way you're living your life, and the way you'll die is in that US dollar paradigm as the only possible way to interact with each other. The problem with that is that there is a giant parasite basically perched over the US dollar system that is this banking community that creates the US dollars, the vast majority of them anyway, as debt that is owed back at interest to the private banks, which is really great if you happen to own one of those private banks, not so great if you're one of the other people who actually have to work to earn a living. And I think it's in the realization of that fundamental part of the economy, that the monetary base that underlies the economy is essentially a big parasite mechanism through which the banks can suck up the blood and sweat and tears and labor of the actual people who make the country what it is. Once people get their heads around that, then I think it is time to start exploring some of the alternative monetary paradigms that are possible. And at this stage, I would say that there isn't a lot of great examples that you can point to, certainly in the United States itself, because again, the fundamental prevailing paradigm is just so complete and total that most people don't even consider the idea that anything could possibly exist, anything else could possibly exist. But there are still examples that you could point to, things like Ithaca Hours as a lets-based system of a local exchange trading system where people contribute their labor and are rewarded with this alternative community currency, which then they can use to spend on local businesses that are accepted by local credit unions. It has accounted for millions of dollars of transactions in the Ithaca area in the couple of decades since it's been founded, and is an example of the type of community system that can exist. And then looking beyond that, there are beyond communities that can work in some fashion like that. We can look at things like cyber currencies, cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and others for transacting in larger networks. But I think it's important for people to at least start exploring the idea, the possibility that it is the dollar itself, that every time you're using one of these dollars in your transactions, you are to a certain extent consigning some of your lifeblood over to the banks for basically the privilege of being able to use their pieces of paper, or more frequently just the zeros and ones, the electronic bits and bytes that are floating around the system. That doesn't sound like a system that really works for anyone except, again, the people who are perched on top of it. And the worst part is that most people don't even really know or think about that aspect of it at all, because again, people have been trained that it's crazy to ask where money comes from, because of course it comes from trees. What are you? Are you a child? Ha ha ha. And people have basically been, I think, purposefully miseducated about the monetary history of the United States, for example, but people around the world more generally, precisely because it is in the interest of the people who control that system to have people who don't really understand what money is, where it comes from, how it's created, how it's extinguished, and what interests benefit from that current system of control.
If we were to project forward now, we have about 5 minutes left. I'd like your insight on what you believe are the most likely outcomes, realizing it's subjective, and it's a guesstimate, of what the likely outcome to the first year or two of Trump's presidency, if he makes 2 years, what will America look like, or our system look like? And also, do you believe that Wall Street's going to have a major correction? Do you see any of these bubbles that we're living in and living in denial in, having a major impact? And do you see that global warming will be the outside visitor to our system that throws any part of our system into some real serious crisis? Then we get some attention paid to it. Those three areas, please.
Let me see if I can remember all three areas. In terms of the Trump presidency, the first year or two, and what we can expect, perhaps I'm a bit biased being based in the Asia Pacific region, but I think that the U.S.-China relationship and what ultimately comes of that is going to portend a lot about not just U.S. Security or economy, but really the global economic situation, with China having been the driver of global economic growth for the last several years. That itself based largely on a credit bubble that the Chinese government has blown, which could itself pop. But at any rate, it is still the sort of tenuous string on which global growth is predicated at the moment. And that is threatening, potentially, maybe to end, depending on what types of tariffs or what have you are thrown on Chinese goods in the coming weeks, months, or years. And perhaps we'll get the first whiff of what that will look like after Xi Jinping meets with Trump later this week. So I would say if we do see some sort of trade war eventuate between China and the United States, that would be a triggering mechanism for the popping of the bubble of unreality that we've been living in the past 10 years almost of basically Federal Reserve created or central bank generally created credit bubble that has propped up the economy in that sort of fake recovery that you were talking about earlier, where people are the jobless recovery, where no one's actually benefiting from it. But trust us, it's great. It's great for everyone. So that bubble of unreality is being threatened to pop. And if it doesn't come from that, it could just as easily come from the Federal Reserve, which is at least saying they're going to continue raising rates throughout the year. We'll see if that happens. If it does happen, I think there's a very good chance that it could pop the bubble that it is itself has funded and created in the S&P and the Dow. So that is, I think, one of the primary points at which this could all fail. And that would give Trump supporters, I guess, something to hinge on. They could say, well, it was the Federal Reserve that killed the economy, not Trump. But at any rate, whatever happens, I think we will not be living in a happy world when that happens. So I don't think that would be anything to gloat about either way. So there is a lot of danger ahead. And when you have a bubble form, the only two ways out are either a pop of some sort or a slow deflation, or perhaps even best would be a actually growing the economy to fit the bubble that you've created. But the only way I think that would even be theoretically feasible would be some sort of game-changing free energy technology or something that would completely change our understanding of the universe. So barring that, I don't know if there's going to be a soft landing for this. That's the best we could hope for, but it seems a distant possibility at this point. And there's so many political rupture points, let alone economic and geopolitical rupture points that are coming in the next couple of years. So it's going to be a very, very bumpy ride. As for the climate change part of the question, I think you might not have researched my climate change views, because I certainly am not in line with the idea that, we have the ability to measure the global average temperature to within 100th of a degree Celsius, let alone even define what the global average temperature is. And I certainly don't think that it's going to end human civilization as we know it. But again, I'm not a climate scientist, so don't take my word for that.
Okay, well, you've given us an awful lot of good insights, and I appreciate it, James. And James's documentaries that I would definitely recommend people watch, Century of Enslavement and How Big Oil Conquered the World. His website is Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com, CorbettReport.com. Thank you very much for being with us today, James.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I'm Gary Knoll. You've been listening to Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a hey, big party, man.
Yeah,
I
brother,
can
like,
dig
like,
it.
Stop right
on. What's up? Hey, man, what's your name?
What's
up? What's
everything?
Get down and
dig
it.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know.